fifth chapter. Brother, we'd like to think of this chapter in two ways. The first way will be as we think it unfolded literally with literal Babylon and Daniel, the Lord's representative there, and then we'd like to reconsider it again a second way, what we think is spiritual nominal Babylon, as it were, and those whom Daniel might represent. First, we'd like to bring out that this chapter is a change. The fifth chapter is a change from the first four in the sense that now we're not under Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel's experiences, but now we're under Belshazzar, the last of the Babylonian kings. This chapter is a record that is supported historically by the ancient historian Herodotus and Xenophon, both recognized authorities. They don't mention Daniel, but they do mention the events that Daniel is relating here. That is the literal fall of that head of gold empire. Belshazzar's name was found on monuments. Brother Russell records that for us in the reprint. So we do feel very strongly that this is, of course, a historical event, and we point to these things as proof that we can use to try to convince skeptics. But nonetheless, picking up with that, we think that there is a Babylon as a city was very unique. In fact, Brother Russell makes mention that even to today, there's aspects of literal Babylon that are unrivaled. Now, Herodotus visited the city probably 100 years after its fall, but it wasn't in ruins at that point as yet. And this is what he records, that Babylon was built and it straddled the Euphrates rivers. Half was on one side, half was on the other side of the river. It was built on a great flat plain, as already brought out. It was a fertile plain because of the waters coming down the Euphrates. So what they did was they dug a giant moat, and it was four square, 14 miles down each side. And as they dug out that moat, they used that dirt or mud, and they mixed it with bitumen that they brought from a lake in the northern part of the empire. They mixed it together for their brick, and then they built up their wall. So when you ever ask yourself where they got all this mud to build these bricks for the wall, they dug it out of the moat. And then they heaped it up right there. And they say that the walls were 350 feet tall. That's a 35-story building. 80 feet wide, where they actually had houses built on either side of it, and you could still drive a four-horse chariot down along the top of it. That's the wall. It's massive. What they did was, where the river Euphrates flowed through the city, they had gates of brass that came down into the water, so that at night when they lowered these brass gates, as it were, or copper, ships couldn't come into the city. But that wasn't the end of it. Along the banks of the river, inside the city walls, they again built walls up so that even if you were in the river, you couldn't get into the city if they had the gates closed along the walls on either side of the river within the city. So each half of the city was almost a city to itself. And they built a great bridge that spanned the river Euphrates, and they had gates on that at either end so that you couldn't go from one side to the other at night when the gates were down. They were growing their crops in the fertile plain inside the city. That's like 52 square miles. So we can see, when we read about this account of Belshazzar's feast, why the Babylonians felt so confident inside this fortress city. It had never been taken previously. Well, what had happened, the setting, is that the Medes and the Persians ganged up together into one kingdom to try to throw off this Babylonian empire. They had won a succession of victories and basically beaten the Babylonian army back into their city. So they were holed up. Cyrus had encamped about the city, Babylon. They had besieged it for a period of time and realized there was no way they were going to take such a heavily fortified city through outward siege. So he took the better part of his army and he placed it on the one side of the city where the river flowed in, and he placed another part of his army where the river flowed out. Then, the part of the army, which really wasn't his main warriors, he took upriver, or upstream. And what the stratagem he came upon was brilliant. It was probably of the Lord's doing, as we'll read in Isaiah. It was prophesied Cyrus would be the man the Lord would use to dethrone Babylon, as it were. He was in the north of the city, up the river Euphrates. And a monarch prior to Belshazzar had done something very interesting. They had dug out a huge lake. And they had diverted the river Euphrates into this huge lake in order to reroute the river with a couple of bends before it got to the city to slow the river down, much like your Corps of Army Engineers might do today to tame a river. And when they diverted the water into this big lake, they made a couple of bends in the river, and when they had everything the way they wanted it, they brought the river back into its old bed, separated it from this lake, and the river flowed now in its new course through the city, and it made this lake now, after a couple of years, it turned into just a marsh. And people thought, oh, well, that was a wonderful defensive move to put this big marshy area north of the city because that would impede an attacking army. Well, I guess they kind of forgot about how that marsh came into being, but somehow it came to Cyrus's mind, if we can remove the earth between that marsh and the river channel, we can divert the river back over into that marsh. Lower the water table of the river, and we can get in under the gates. That's a good stratagem. Two things had to happen, though. One is he had to gradually remove the earth between the river and this lake bed, this marshy area, but not take all the earth out at once until he was ready to march. But even if he lowered the water table, how? They'd get under those first gates, but how are they going to get through the walls along the riverbed inside the city? They had to get through those gates, too. And that's where he realized, in some manner, it came to his attention, there would be this great feast. Probably a religious festival of some type. And that they learned that there would be great revelry in the city. And they took it, will attack, on that night. So his stage was set. They'd wait till the evening when they would be drinking in the city. They would remove the remaining parts of the earth between the river and this marsh. The water would be drained off. And Herodotus records that when the water got to the thighs of the soldiers marched into the city through the riverbed, and the gates to the city were open on the inside, and they had access. They took the city that night. There was a great slaughter. The Babylonians were so intoxicated, they didn't even hardly fight back from what we read. But the city was so big that it's recorded that it took 2 days for parts of the city to realize they had been captured. Turn with me in the book of Isaiah, and we'll just read quickly on that account. Isaiah 44 and verse 27. Thus saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. Thus saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shalt be laid. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings, to open before him the two-leaved gates. And I think that's the gates to the river. And that was because they lowered the water table. Back up to verse 27, I'll dry up the rivers. That got him through these two gates. The one at the front of the city, the one at the back of the city. And then it says, back in verse 1, and the gate shall not be shut. That's the gates, I think, that lead from the river up into the city proper. Because of their drunken revelry, they were partying. And they left the city unguarded inside at these gates because they felt they were impregnable. I will go before thee, and I will make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron, and I will give thee the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places. Well, that was the bounty. That was the reward Cyrus was after. He wanted the gold and the silver of the temples and in the palaces, the things that were kept out of sight of the common man. That was the bounty he was after, and the Lord let him have that. That thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which called thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. Well, he called him by name here in the prophecy of Isaiah. He called him by name Cyrus before he ever used him, before Cyrus was ever born. It was prophesied. So it's Isaiah as the spokesman for the Lord recording that he knew him by name. For Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. That's the point. The Lord's using Cyrus for natural Israel's sake. But he's going to allow Cyrus to have the rewards of material wealth, the hidden riches of darkness, as his part. Okay. So, brethren, we just point this out as a further proof of how things unfolded. And historically we have the record, but here we have a prophetic record. It should be very faith-strengthening for us. Okay, now back to Belshazzar's feast in Daniel 5. Starting in verse 1. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels which were taken out of the temple of the house of God which is at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of copper, of iron, of wood, and stone. Brethren, get the picture before our minds. A great feast of 1,000 of his lords, and his family members were there, and they're drinking. And the way it says, it phrases it, that Belshazzar drank before 1,000. It was as if he was showing off how much he could drink, like he could drink more than these lords in front of him. He was being a fool. And he's intoxicated. And unfortunately, we've witnessed this, and maybe you have too, but quite often intoxication isn't accompanied by an emboldened spirit, a haughty spirit of thinking more of oneself than they should. And it's almost as if there's a rivalry of who can outboast the next. And we think that's what Belshazzar got caught up into here. And so what could he do? What more? How powerful and great could he show himself to be but to call for the vessels of Jehovah? And they brought them. And here he distributes them amongst his concubines, his wives, and the lords, and they're drinking toast out. They're partying with the Lord's vessels. And this was the attitude. In that very hour, verse 5, in that same hour, so that there was no mistaking on the part of Belshazzar or the host there that this was of the Lord. In that same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against the other. And the king cried aloud, "Bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers." And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Oh, he sobered up very quickly. Here they were praising their gods, which are man-made idols, gold, silver, wood, and stone. Something supernatural really happens. And suddenly, he's sobered up, and he is shaking so bad, his knees are knocking together. And I'll let you, in your own imagination, imagine what it means to have the bands or joints of your loins loose. So here, the king, who was so proud and boastful, is now reduced to kind of a, what shall we say, a trembling, frightened, hysterical man. Now he's looking for hope wherever he can get it. He offers all that he can basically offer without just giving them the kingship. So he calls in his religious people, and they can't read it either. Now he's in a fix. For all his money, he can't buy peace of mind. I'm the king. How come I'm shaking in my boots? It's because he had blasphemed the Lord. Now, in verse 10, it tells us that the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house. Apparently, she wasn't there for this drinking binge. And Brother Russell suggests this was probably the king's mother, not his wife. Queen Mom. They have that in England today. spake and said, O king, live forever, and let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There's a man in thy kingdom in whom the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father the king, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit, and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences, and the dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let now Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Now this is so interesting. Here, this queen mother comes in. She showed some proper reserve that she wasn't part of this rivalry. And she comes in, though, and she's troubled because her son's troubled. And what does she do? But she remembers that there was this Daniel who could interpret the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. And we'll suggest here that it's Nebuchadnezzar was Belshazzar's grandfather. So here, Daniel's called in. He can understand the hard things. He had interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream before, is brought out. And he has an excellent spirit. Now, isn't that marvelous way to be remembered of not only his abilities, but his character is remembered. He was blameless. And that is quite a statement. Now, when we read on here in verse 13, let's pick up some more interesting points. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, Art thou that Daniel who art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king of my father brought out of Jewry? I have even heard of thee. Now, we don't want to say it was just a few minutes ago, but he's saying, I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom be found in thee. So, just here, the irony is just almost overwhelming. He, Belshazzar, was blaspheming Jehovah God by partying with his sacred vessels. They were praising the gods of gold, silver, stone. He called in, when something supernatural happened, he calls in his soothsayers, his religious leaders, and they can't help him. Who does he call but a Jew, a worshiper of the very God he was blaspheming by partying with his vessels to help him in his hour of distress? We notice that the king doesn't call him Belteshazzar, which is really his own name. He's trying to show a distinction here. So he calls him by his Hebrew name of Daniel. Now we read on. And in verse 16, the king offers to Daniel the same rewards. In verse 17, though, Daniel answers. Now before we read that answer, let's think for a moment. Here's Daniel. He's apparently in the city, probably because of this great siege that had laid hold upon the land. Probably the leaders of the empire were brought back to the city for safety. He was probably somewhere near the vicinity of the palace. They sent for him. He comes, and he knows what's going on. Now stop and think. Daniel had been studying the book of Isaiah, so he knew about the prophecy we just read regarding Cyrus and what was going to happen. Daniel knew about the image. He knew it was time for Babylon to change over to Medo-Persia, and here's the Medo-Persians knocking on the door. He also was reading in the book of Jeremiah. He understood about the 70 years starting in 606 B.C., and now here they are about 539, 538. So he realizes the next couple of years his people have to be let go. He's putting this all together, and he's watching current events. He says, we're all hedged in. So Daniel, as he is walking to and through this hall, he in his own mind must have been moved with the recognition, this is the momentous event we've been waiting for. This is the next step, proving the dream interpretation and the prophecy. And I am going to have the privilege of speaking it before the king and 1,000 lords. The stage was set by God, not by Daniel. But Daniel was that man of the hour. He's aged, probably 100 years old. He walks through. You can imagine the anticipation on these lords and the kings. Everyone's looking to him. You're our last hope. And he walks in. He's made this wonderful offer by the king. You'd think he'd be awestruck. And what does he say in verse 17? Let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. What was the motive of Daniel? His motive was he was being faithful to Jehovah God. He didn't care about the rewards, and he wanted the king to know, I am not mercenary, but I am going to do the interpretation. O thou king, the most high God, gave Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, language, trembled and feared before him. Whom he would slew, he would slay. And him who he keep alive, he could keep alive. And him who he set up, he could also put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, as Brother Ken had just related, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. The 7 literal years of being as a beast. The end of verse 21. That he was beast-like till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointed over it whomsoever he will. Now here's the driving point. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, has not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and have praised the gods of silver, gold, brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know not. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, that is the God who counts, and who all thy ways hast thou not glorified. Daniel took this opportunity, before he began the interpretation, to drive the point home, not to the king alone, but to all sitting there listening. Your gods which you praise are nothing, nothing. They don't hear, they don't see. And you should have known and humbled yourself because of the great lesson your grandfather had passed through. So in other words, Daniel was telling him, you're without excuse. And the judgment that's written and will be soon carried out is because of your own fault. God gave you a chance, and you didn't take advantage of it. So that's why Daniel takes the time to paint this picture. But then he continues in verse 24, then was the part of the hand sent from him. Okay, make no doubt it was from Jehovah, and this writing was written. And this is the writing. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Peres, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Just here, if we were to sum those words up, numbered, numbered, short weight. In other words, mene, they were numbered. The kingdom was numbered. And tekel, there was a short weight. They were put in the great balance of God's justice, and they were light. They were found wanting. So what would happen? Upharsin, they are crushed to pieces and destroyed. They're divided and crushed. And indeed, he tells them, it's going to be at the hands of the Medes and Persians. That must have struck fear into those that heard the words, because they knew the Medes and the Persians were without the gate. But you know what? About this time, the Medes and the Persians were probably within the gates and marching on the palace. Verse 29, then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Why did Daniel let them do that? Maybe it was for the benefit of the other Jewish people that were under their control. I think there's a lesson for us in this. But he let it be known that wasn't his reason for interpreting the message. So just here it tells us in verse 30 that in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. You can almost imagine, as Daniel, having spoken his piece as the mouth spokesperson of the Lord, walking out of the hall, we can almost, as it were, envision the Persians and the Medes coming in the palace, right on his heels. The interesting part was he had the scarlet or purple. He was given the gold chain, but how could he be the third ruler in the kingdom if the kingdom was just removed? And we think it's wonderfully fulfilled that in the 6th chapter, verse 2, when Darius is ruling, what does he do? Over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first. So Daniel did become, as it were, a third ruler in the kingdom, but it was in the next empire. Well, we marvel at how wonderfully Daniel and courageously Daniel delivered the message that the Lord had given him. But he was prepared. He had studied, and he was watching the prophetic horizon of what was going on in order to, on short notice, go forth and speak the words of the Lord at the appropriate time, but with the right spirit. It wasn't a haughty message, "I told you so." No. But he plainly declared that the Lord had given you, as Babylonians, an opportunity to repent and humble thyselves, and this is how you conduct yourselves. The punishment, the judgment would sit. Well, now what we'd like to do is go back through these verses and look to see if there's antitypical lessons. Now, Brother Russell, what I would like to do is give you several references to look at in your leisure. 5 references. Reprint 2498, 4901, the 4th volume, page 25, the sermon book, page 409 to 411, and lastly, this is from Harvest Gleanings 1, page 521, 521. And for your information, that's from a Bible Student Monthly article, which was published from 1909 onward. Then sometimes, you know, in the Harvest Gleanings, in the earliest parts, it's the three worlds and so on. It might be barbarous thinking. Well, this, we think, is this is from a Bible Student Monthly. This is later, so we give it more weight. All of those references, when you look at them, you will see for yourself that Brother Russell brings out that the fall of literal Babylon was a prototype, that's his word, is a prototype of the fall of nominal spiritual Babylon. And then he draws out some similarities. When you look at those similarities, allow it to convince you what you think of it. I'm going to give similarities Brother Russell has mentioned in those places, and I'm going to suggest some others. And I'm not always going to break down the two for time's sake, but I encourage you to look at it and do it for yourself if you haven't already. So I'm kind of giving you a warning that way. Now, I will quote from that Bible Student Monthly, the Harvest Gleaning page, 521, where Brother Russell, regarding the great feast and revelry, says, quote, "Great denominational union of church federation is expected soon, and a short season of rejoicing which will accompany it." He thought that was this picture of this feast. Now, building on that, or following that lead, what we would suggest is this great feast that's gathered and these hosts together is this combination of a church-state cooperative effort, and we, brethren, I think it's still before us. I think when Babylon falls, there will be no questions in anyone's mind, and today we still see religious systems in existence. We still see religious leaders going about and hobnobbing with world leaders. And when Babylon is destroyed, fallen, in that sense, not fallen from God's favor as it was in 1878, but destroyed, fallen, these religious leaders won't be hobnobbing with world leaders. There won't be any question in anyone's mind on this fact. Cyrus, we think, pictures, in fact, the name Cyrus means sun, like the sun. We think that pictures Jesus. And in Revelation, the 16th chapter, verse 12, under the sixth plague, it talks about the great river Euphrates being dried up. And that takes our mind to what Cyrus did here in drying up the rivers of the water Euphrates to undermine the city of Babylon, literal Babylon. Well, we think that's based on Revelation 16. We have prophetic license to interpret that that's going to be the turning aside of economic support for church-state cooperation and also turning aside of the people, because waters can represent people as well. It's turning aside the people support for a church-state cooperation. I think that's still future, because there are still people who would like to see a church-state. Just ask Jerry Falwell. He would like to see that. And there's others. So I think that hasn't happened yet. I think that is yet before us. We would also suggest that in that Revelation 16:12, it says the waters are turned aside, the Euphrates are turned aside in order to prepare the way of the kings of the east. I think that's the church in glory with Jesus. It's the church coming from the sunrise. I think that yet is before us. Literal Babylon, it's recorded in Jeremiah 51, verse 8, fell suddenly. That's the word used there. Brother Russell picks up on that from Revelation, the 18th chapter, verse 10, where it says Babylon fell in 1 hour, and he links it to Jeremiah 51:8, saying this is suddenly, 1 hour. It's a very short period of time. So I don't think it's talking about the whole time period from when Babylon was cast off in 1878 down to a future point. I don't think that's what suddenly in 1 hour. I think it was cast off in 1878, but this is talking about its sudden fall, its destructive, its destruction as coming suddenly, which we think is yet ahead of us. It's been weakened since 1878, but that's what we expect because the papists and the Protestants are to roll together as two ends of a thorny scroll, and they do so because they both feel their weakness. So when we see weakening, that doesn't surprise us because accompanying it is this ecumenical movement that we see as well. Now, the great feast and rivalry we talked about, but the wine, the drinking, they brought forth the gold and silver vessels, drinking vessels, as it were, out from the temple that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jehovah's temple in Jerusalem. Brother Russell interprets that as applying it to the precious truths, gold and silver truths, that contain beautiful doctrines. But what did papacy and Protestantism do with these beautiful truths out of the Word of God? Well, they took those truths and they perverted them. They took those cups and they filled them with the filthiness of their fornication. You know, it's true that Jesus and his church are going to reign as kings and priests. That's true. That hasn't happened yet, except in an initial sense with the resurrected saints. But the Catholic Church applied it to themselves going back into the counterfeit millennium, starting in 800. So they took a truth, a golden truth about reigning, and they applied it to themselves back there. They corrupted it. They filled it with the fornication of their filthiness. They took the thought of a kings and priests together, and instead of waiting for the proper King Jesus to return as kings and priests, they tried to align themselves. They were the priests, and they aligned themselves with the kings of the earth. This, again, was taking that truth and corrupting it, making it a fornication. So the long and short of it is that they are taking truth of the Lord and they filled it with the filthiness of their fornication. That's their false doctrines, and that's what they're intoxicated with. Now, they also, in literal Babylon, felt great peace and safety, even though they were surrounded by this impending doom. And that reminds us of 1 Thessalonians 5:3, that they cry peace and safety when sudden destruction is ready to befall them. That's exactly what happened in this situation, and it's about to happen before us. That's like the stock market. They're all buying into it. It goes great, great, great. Well, it's just lifting them up before they crash down. The higher they are, the harder they fall. And is there any better way to humble all of the middle class than to have all their retirements and their pension funds, which are all invested, whether they're doing it or their corporation or company they work for is doing it, have it all wiped out in the stock market? I can't think of a better way to humble them, and then you're only going to have your rich and your poor then. You just totally wipe out your middle class. Well, peace and safety prior to sudden destruction. Now, the word Belshazzar is interesting, and Belteshazzar, they're really the same name. Bel means Lord, and Shazzar means to favor or protect. So you have Belshazzar claiming to be favored of the Lord, first reigning in this drunken sense, but the real Belteshazzar is going to be the one that ended up reigning afterwards, even as the church will end up reigning with their Lord following the demise of this despotic reign now. The drinking of the intoxicated wine, we give you the reference of Revelation 17:2 and 18:3. They praise their gods of gold, silver, stone, and so on, man-made idols in their drunkenness. And so today, the church has put forth their social work as being goodness before the Lord. And we appreciate social work, but brethren, so many of these ones doing this social work and claiming this is the work of the Lord, they're teaching that countless billions are going to roast forever in eternal torment. Is it pleasing to help a few here with a good work and then condemn them for eternity to roast in a hellfire? What do we think the Lord makes of that? We've got to call it for what it is. The fruit of the false vine of the earth looks good outwardly to man's thinking. But from the Lord's perspective, they're blaspheming his character. And we would have no part of that. That's what they praise, is what outwardly they can demonstrate. But actually, they're intoxicated with their own wine and they're teaching blasphemous things. It says, in that same hour, these singers came forth. And we think it's the hour here, we would suggest, would be the same as the hour in which the ten kings which had no power as yet give their power. 1 hour unto the beast to make war against the Lamb and those who are with him, called, chosen, and faithful. Revelation 17:12. I think it's the same. The fingers of a man's hands. What we would suggest on this is that it's from God. But a man's hands, a finger, the Lord uses a human agent to forecast in writing the doom of Babylon. Who was the man who wrote that? Brother Russell, in the fourth volume, wrote the doom of Babylon. He wrote it in the past. But the time is coming in that hour of power of this church-state cooperation in which we believe they will be forced to recognize what Brother Russell wrote in that fourth volume as applying to themselves and recognize that doom, that judgment against them. The fingers of a man's hand that wrote these fiery letters that prophesied the judgment of Babylon. Now it was seen and it was written over by the candle stand or the lamp stand. And so you can only understand this judgment message in the light of God's Word. And the astrologers couldn't understand it because you had to have the proper character that Daniel had to be able to interpret it. They could probably see the letters as they were written in Chaldean, but it was the arrangement or the orders in which these letters were written that they couldn't understand. And so the Lord will reveal it to His faithful servants. The astrologers, the Chaldeans, and these other soothsayers probably represent the theologians and priests and the ministers of which this church-state cooperative will call for to try to respond when they're faced with the truth in the future, that they can't get away from these hard truths, this judgment message. But those theologians will have no answer. Some manner in which we can't explain, even as we're not sure who this queen represents or what she represents, but Daniel, who has been forgotten as the Lord's spokesman, will be remembered. He has a beautiful character, and he can understand these deep things because he did in the past. He's called forth. Brethren, we're that forgotten group. No one thinks about Bible students as interpreting prophecy today. They did in 1914 when Brother Russell had been writing about the fall of things. And when World War I broke out, a lot of people started paying heed to what he had said. But then things seemed to settle down more or less, and the Bible students are forgotten. But we think the time is coming in that hour. As unlikely as it might seem, even as unlikely as it might have seemed that anyone would think of Daniel, the Lord will set the stage and this humble character will come forth. We think it will be the final feet members of the church. And they will come forth and they will be privileged to point back to Brother Russell's writings, because that's how we've understood anything about the fall of Babylon, point out from Scripture that this is what was prophesied. And now it's come to pass. As unlikely as it was for Daniel, as unlikely as it might be in your thinking that how could we have a voice in the future, it's certainly not beyond the power of our God when the situation or the stage is set. As Daniel refused the honors, so too the feet members served God from a willing heart. Daniel brought out about Nebuchadnezzar's former pride and humblings. So too the feet members might point out the Reformation work and the humbling that Napoleon dealt to the papacy in the past. You should have learned this wasn't what the Lord would have you to do, to cooperate in a church-state effort. And here you are today. You've had those warnings in the past, but you wouldn't be reformed, and you wouldn't hearken. And so now you cannot be healed. There is no balm that can heal Babylon. You are to be destroyed. He brings out in this message of being judged, doesn't it sound just like the Laodicean message? You think you have all this wealth, but you're just prideful. You're haughty. And that's describing the nominal systems of today. They're prideful and haughty even though they think they're God's representatives. But they're found wanting. They lack in weight of spiritual substance. And their demise will be brought about. We're told in Jeremiah 51:7 that Babylon had been a golden cup in the Lord's hands. And yet, indeed, they filled that cup with the filthiness of her fornication and was so rejected. If we are so faithful to be of this Daniel class, let us take heart in Revelation, the 10th chapter, verse 11, which says, "Thou must prophesy again before many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings," world leaders. And the Lord sets the stage and gives the opportunity. Let us not hesitate to step through it. There was an exaltation that followed, but we think it will be of the Lord's doing. When that Daniel class is complete and they've faithfully given their message, they will be robed in the scarlet or the purple royalty. They will be given the gold chain, the divine office, the divine nature. And they will be the third ruler in the country. Jehovah as one, Jesus as the second, and the church's bride as the third. And indeed, they will rule in the kingdom that follows that demise of mystic Babylon, which will be the fifth universal empire. Lastly, after the waters were diverted by Cyrus's engineers, the army swept into the city under the gates. Doesn't that remind you of Joel, the second chapter, verses 7 through 11 of the Lord's great army sweeping in? And we think it is the Lord's great army that will sweep in and bring down the nominal systems. Now, I am over, and I asked the permission from the chairman to dispense with the closing hymn if I could read you part of a poem. I hope you don't mind. The poem was written in 1852, and it's called Belshazzar's Feast. Written by Edwin Arnold. I'm going to quote but the tail end of it. And this starts out, as we pick up in the poem, as Belshazzar quaking and seeing the prophet enter into the king's the palace hall. This is where we pick up. "Art thou the prophet? Read me yonder scroll, whose undeciphered horror daunts my soul. Where shall be Gwirdwin for the grateful task? Fit it for me to give, for thee to ask. A chain to deck thee, and a robe to grace? Thine the third throne, and thou the third in place." He heard and turned where the lighted wall dimmed the red torches of the festival, gazed on the sign with steady gaze and set, and he who quailed